I'm Christopher Lydon with the MIT economist Daron Acemoglu. He's the co-author of this stunning bestseller on the deep history of poverty and power. It's called Why Nations Fail. And once you've read it and heard the debates around it, there's no avoiding the question, is this book talking about us? This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. It's a thrill, Professor Acemoglu, to meet a storyteller and a scientific economist of your magnitude. The stories abound in Why Nations Fail. James Watt and his steam engine in 18th century England, the Spanish Empire in Latin America, Rosa Parks in 20th century Montgomery, Alabama. We've got to get to a lot of them. But speak to Americans in the shaken economy and the presidential campaign year of 2012. When you talk about extractive systems, what should we be hearing about us?
You know, the main concept of the book is extractive institutions. And what we try to sort of communicate with that notion is two things. First, that at the root of poverty of most nations is a set of institutions that don't provide incentives for investment, don't provide incentives for innovation, and create a tilted playing field so that the most of the society are unable to deploy their talents. And second, as the word extractive suggests, that these institutions are not there by mistake. They have been designed to actually extract resources from the majority of the population for the benefit of a few, which we sometimes refer to as the elite. And it's really key to understand the politics of these extractive institutions, meaning how it is that the elite are able to structure them, how is it that they are able to keep them in place, and what this implies for prosperity, economic growth, poverty, and so on. Many of these notions are key for understanding the dangers that lie ahead for the U.S. society also.
Start at the beginning with the empires, Cortez in Mexico, or, you know, the settlement of the Gold Coast in West Africa. All of these explicitly getting things out of the ground, industries and empires, not to mention modern-day oil. I mean, we are in an extractive world, an extractive century. Still, what does that mean about our politics?
Well, let me give you some examples of what I mean by extractive. So it's not just that you're extractive oil or mineral from the ground. It's really how you do it. So if you look at the institutions that the Spaniards, the Spanish conquistadors, set up in South America, they are really archetypal examples of extractive institutions, not because they were simply extracting silver, for example, as in the Potosi mine in today's Bolivia and Peru, but in the way that they were doing it. They were doing it by forced labor. They had set up a whole system of mita by taking over an institution that the Incas had before, but intensifying it so that there was a huge catchment area. And within that catchment area, all males were forced to go and work in the mines under appalling conditions with very high mortality, whether they wanted to or not. These people did not have any occupational choice. They were essentially a form of slaves. And that's just one of the extractive institutions that the Spaniards set up. They set up the encomienda, repartimiento, trajín, all of these things that were ways of forcing people to work for the elite, produce for the elite, get paid low wages, and as a result, enrich the elite, but they themselves did not have the opportunity to realize their calling in life, use their talents, or get engaged in any sort of activity that would enrich themselves or the society.
Cut to the French or the British in the Caribbean extracting sugar or tobacco. Or really, let's cut to Saudi Arabia in the 20th century, 21st century, oil to keep the American and Western industrial machine running.
You know, you're absolutely right. If you think of the British setting up the plantation colonies in Jamaica, Barbados, the French doing it in Haiti, it's no different. The specific institutions were somewhat different. You had slavery in the Caribbean. You did not have slavery in many parts of Latin America. You had it in Colombia, but not for example, in Peru for the most part. But the purpose of these institutions were the same. In South Africa, you did not have explicit coerced labor, but you had color bar, which meant that black South Africans couldn't enter a whole array of skilled occupations. So the only thing that was left open to them was manual labor. And in fact, they were not even allowed to become self-sufficient farmers. So the only thing left open to them was to become manual labor at very cheap wages. So it's not slavery, but it's essentially another extractive institution. But what I want to emphasize, it's not about the British and the French, and we can come back to this, but it's also not just about whether you're extracting something from the ground. So today, one of the fastest growing economies still is Botswana. Botswana has a modern economy, but it is built on diamond. But it is not an extractive economy. If you look at how Botswana achieved that status, it achieved it by being very different from pretty much every other country in sub-Saharan Africa. It achieved it by being a democracy. It achieved it by adopting economic institutions and economic policies that were reasonably sensible, building a bureaucracy, creating an education system, being relatively meritocratic. And it did so because of its politics. And as a result, it could still be an economy based on minerals, but an inclusive economy.
Just remind us, I mean, how did that exception happen? And just how rare an exception is it?
Oh, unfortunately, it's very rare. I mean, simplifying it a little bit, achieving prosperity is not a big mystery. If you have what we call inclusive institutions, prosperity generally follows. If you create incentives for innovation, investment, and that broad thing that we call level playing field, most societies grow. But the sad thing is that most societies throughout history, and even most societies today, are ruled by extractive institutions. Mm. So it is very rare for societies to make the transition from extractive to inclusive. And in sub-Saharan Africa, Botswana is the only case that you can clearly pinpoint as a society that has built successful inclusive institutions and as a result has been able to achieve economic growth. So at some level, you know, it's a very hopeful story, because if anybody says, you know, there is something about Africa that sort of condemns them to poverty, there's a very clear counterexample. It's the fastest growing country. It's been really now reached living standards that are comparable to middle income countries in other parts of the world. So it would be like Mexico. But on the other hand, if you want an easy solution, how you can turn Malawi into the next Mexico or the next Portugal, it shows you it's not easy. You know, you really need to leverage existing institutions. Some of them may be really very much damaged, not like the ones that the pre-colonial tribal institutions that Botswana had. And you really need to make sure that either your leaders are totally committed to this endeavor, or when they're not, you can control them. You can replace them when they start misbehaving. And that's where, you know, many post-independence countries have had difficulty with, not just in Africa.
Play with that word extractive a little bit. It's not just about digging things out of the ground, although it is that. It's not just about exporting profits to London, but it is about that. It's also about institutions that permit enterprise, experimentation, innovation, inclusion, pluralism, etc. What does it mean in today's world, specifically in the United States? I'm going to push you on that one.
And let me start by sort of making a key distinction that we make in the book, which is between economic and political institutions. So imagine, again, let's go back to the plantation colonies that we mentioned, a society like Barbados. You know, if you look at Barbados in the 17th century, 90% of the society is made up of slaves. Most of the land is owned by even a much smaller fraction of the key top planters. How does a society like that survive? For example, if it had democracy, could it survive? Of course not. If it had democracy, if it really gave some voice to the 90% of the population that are toiling as slaves, that society wouldn't survive. So for that society to survive in that very, very extractive form, with very, very extractive economic institutions, it needs to have a particular distribution of political power. And lo and behold, that is exactly what it had. That small planter class not only controlled all the land, it controlled all of the judicial positions, it controlled all of the bureaucracy, and it controlled the military, it controlled the governorship. So they had total control of political power. So in other words, there was an extreme form of political inequality. Only a very small fraction of society, the elite, controlled political power, didn't have to share it, and did not face any restrictions on how they could exercise that political power. And that's why they could suppress slave rebellions ruthlessly. Mm. That's why they could set up a system in which slaves had very, very low life expectancy, That sort of society requires what we call extractive political institutions. So there's extractive economic institutions are supported by extractive political institutions. And the feedback between them is that, of course, they support each other. So once you have that extractive economic institutions, that planter class gets rich. Once it gets rich, it can use its resources to buy more guns and more people to police the slaves, whatever the conditions are.
Bring it home to Montgomery, Alabama. Rosa Parks is a heroine in your fight against the extractive impulse, economic and political. Fit that in.
So let me say a few words about the U.S. South. I mean, I don't think I need to say much about the background, about the antebellum South. You know, a clearly extractive system based on slavery and disenfranchisement of blacks and discrimination against African Americans, blacks, in every aspect of their lives. But then you have the Civil War, and the Civil War becomes centered on emancipation of blacks. And after Civil War, slavery is abolished, the disenfranchisement of blacks ends. But you know, what do we have at the end? At the end, things don't change instantaneously, because we have the redemption period after the Reconstruction, where Southern planter elite is able to reestablish control, now under a different guise. So slavery is gone, but instead of slavery, you have such things as the vagrancy laws or Alabama Black Code. You have convict leasing systems, which are essentially different ways of forcing people to work at very low wages. You have a separate but equal education system, which makes sure that, you know, African-American citizens of the South don't get education and cannot get into skilled occupations, and their mobility is restricted so that they really become a cheap pool of labor for plantation. African-Americans are allowed to vote, but they cannot vote because that's supported by Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow and literacy requirements that effectively disenfranchises them. So we see another instance of extractive institutions persisting. So how is it that these extractive institutions finally start collapsing? So there's only one way in which they collapse, and that's grassroots mobilization of people who want to take part in politics and work to share that power. Without that sort of grassroots mobilization, political equality remains a dream. It cannot become a reality. And that's where Rosa Parks comes in. So things finally start changing in the South with the civil rights era. And the defining thing about civil rights era is not so much the feds being sent from the North. That is important. But the defining thing is that it's a grassroots movement. It's the people in the South, people like Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, all the whole NAACP, and other organizations that really start mobilizing the African-American citizens of the South, that they actually rise up against Jim Crow, against Ku Klux Klan, and against separate but equal. And it is that mobilization, now with the support of federal power of the government, that starts finally transforming the institutions in the U.S. South.
Professor Osmoglu, I'm dying for you to bring this extractive, inclusive contrast home to our politics today, where Wall Street rules the world, oil underpins our industry, and a lot of people wonder if we've been had, including your colleague Simon Johnson here at MIT. But there's so many issues that bear on today, the news, our votes, our politics. Where would you begin?
The right way to think about it, it's a glass half full, half empty thing. It's cliche, but it's true. Broadly speaking, U.S. still has inclusive institutions. Our education system has problems, but it's still much more egalitarian. We have broadly secure property rights. We don't have any restrictions against people choosing whatever occupation they want. We have a free media. We can complain about our government. We can complain about Wall Street. We can complain about the rich who are not paying any taxes. We can complain about our politicians who are either corrupt or misguided. We can do all of these things, and we can even vote them out of office. I mean, you know, at the end, why are the politicians who are in power today in power? Because we voted them in. So at some level, compared to Uzbekistan, compared to Egypt, compared to Saudi Arabia, compared to even Mexico, Central America, there's no comparison between our institutions.
Compared to Uzbekistan, for sure. But also just consider the common sense realities. I'm just thinking of conversations we've had. Simon Sharma, who defends the British Empire in so many ways, also says flat out that the United States has an extractive empire, not only oil, but minerals, precious minerals now. I'm thinking also of Russ Baker's book on the House of Bush, The Bush family made its money on the fringes of the Rockefeller oil empire. It's an extractive instinct. Dick Cheney of Halliburton with George Bush made the first all-oil ticket in American history. And furthermore, people are up in arms about the taxes that Wall Street billionaires avoid. That's a kind of extraction too.
Right.
Fit that in.
Here is what really worries me about the U.S. On the basis of this, I would say U.S. has inclusive institutions, but has already started the slide towards extractive institutions. And it's not just oil. It's not even Wall Street. And it's not just a huge increase in inequality that has soared in the United States over the last 3 or 4 decades. To me, the biggest problem is the increase in political inequality. So let's look at other powers that have rose and declined. And I think the pattern that I see, of course, I'm looking at it through the lenses of my book with Jim. It's one where first political institutions go, and then everything else starts decaying. Look at Venice. Venice rose as a huge economic power starting in the 10th century, and it did so on the basis of, for its time, unusually inclusive institutions that really allowed all sorts of merchants, small to big, to share in the power, sit in the ducal council, and elect who was going to govern them. And on the basis of that equal distribution of political power, they generated a lot of technological innovations. They generated shipping technologies. They generated new contracts that enabled them to share risk better so that they could go to long-distance voyages. And on the basis of that, they became the richest country in the world, perhaps. But then a bunch of people said, we're already rich, and we don't like these new merchants coming and competing against us, even though they are the ones who are really bringing energy to the economy. Mm. So they said, from now on, no additional families are going to be included into the Ducal Council, into the Great Council that will elect the Doge. So that was the end of political equality. And what came next? The collapse of economic institutions. So once political power became concentrated, they started saying, well, we don't want these people to compete against us in the economic sphere either. And in fact, they started banning the contracts and the technologies that had actually made them the great power. And of course, the decline of Venice set in. That is the concern for me. You know, U.S. was known not only mythically, but I think in reality as a politically equal country. But from the time of de Tocqueville to the 1950s, right. It was a time where there were big exceptions to this, and I'll talk about some of them in a second, perhaps, like the Gilded Age. But on the whole, politics wasn't just controlled by the elite. The famous political scientist Robert Dahl wrote this book, Who Governs, about New Haven politics. And to his surprise, what he found is that it was not the elites of New Haven who govern New Haven. It's just average Joe. That you cannot say today. Today, the political system, I believe, and I think there's empirical evidence to show this, to support this, and I'll talk about that in a second, is largely just listening to the very rich. So what we have been creating is political inequality. It's not just super PACs. Super PACs is just the icing on the cake. It's been going on for probably 3 or more decades. Mm. It's lobbying, it's campaign contributions, but it's also just the fact that whenever politicians want to get advice, they turn to the very wealthy, to the captains of industry. And I think that's the real problem in Wall Street. You know, when Hank Paulson, when he wanted to get advice, who did he turn to? He turned to Goldman Sachs, to JP Morgan, to Morgan Stanley. It wasn't that Hank Paulson wanted to save his buddies. Perhaps he did. But the most important thing is that he only trusted them to give him the advice. Right. And the advice, of course, they gave him was exactly what was going to be good for their bottom line. And if Obama or if Bush had any doubt about it, well, all of their campaign contributions and other sort of support comes from this money. So it's the role of money in politics. It really is the root of this inequality. And I think the sort of telling piece of evidence comes from the political scientist Larry Bartels, who wrote a wonderful book called Unequal Democracy. There is one survey in which people are surveyed both about their income and their political views. So he matches them to their senators. And so he can look at what your opinion is about various issues and how the senator has voted on these issues. And what he finds is a striking pattern. Senators are perfectly correlated with their rich constituents. Mm. they are so, so, so correlated with their middle class constituents, meaning the middle 30% of the income distribution. And they're zero or sometimes even negatively correlated with the bottom of their constituents. Mm. So this is what I mean by political inequality. And that, I think, is the real danger for American politics.
This is the world of Citizens United, of super PACs, of the fact that we've already accepted that both major candidates in the fall election will spend $1 billion. A lot of it's secret. That's just one piece of the story. No, this is to me hugely interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think Citizens United, I mean, I think what's crazy about Citizens United is that, you know, it's not just creating a problem. That problem already existed, and instead of dealing with that problem, we're actually making it worse with Citizens United. That's, if there was no Citizens United, we would still have a problem with money in politics. And then on top of it, we have the Citizens United and super PACs, and that's really where the slide becomes very serious. But let me tell you, if I might, why I am still somewhat optimistic. It might be false optimism, but why, even though I am extremely worried about this state of emerging or already has emerged political inequality in the United States, why I'm not willing to say that the United States is irrevocably on its way to becoming a banana republic or an extractive society. And the reason for that is that we've been here before. And the measure of institutions is that it really is about the grassroots. It's really about political equality de facto. And the measure of institutions is that they actually let the non-elite exercise political power, especially when push comes to shove. And we were here before, at the end of the 19th century, in the Gilded Age, in the beginning of the 20th century, when economic inequality had reached even higher levels than it is today, with the robber barons doing it in a much more questionable way than even the bankers of today. And the political institutions we had were much more questionable. We did not have an elected Senate. We had the Electoral College that had a lot of problems relative to the elections of presidents that we have today. We did not have income tax. We did not have a strong federal government that could act as a safety net on people. We did not have as much of an independent judiciary as we have today. But what happened is that at some point people said, you know, enough is enough. So they organized first in the populist movement, then in the progressive movement. And that organization, with the help of the media, for example, which was great at publicizing all of the abuses, political and economic, by the robber barons and the Senate and so on, they started influencing politics in a real way. And it wasn't just that progressive became a voice. They actually brought both parties to their line. It wasn't just Republicans or Democrats. It was both parties. They had to come to the progressive line, and they changed all of the things that were the source of it. The monopolies that were the basis of the Rockefellers that you mentioned, the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts, they were gone with the Clayton Act and the Sherman Act. The Senate became directly elected. The income tax was introduced. The beginning of the welfare state were introduced. So that sort of thing was possible more than 100 years ago. So the question is it impossible today?
And women got the vote, too.
And women got the
vote. This is where it really gets sticky. Your colleague, Simon Johnson, here at MIT, and I gather you've been sort of talking this book through with him for 15 years or so, he wrote the other day in the New York Times, "I'm not so sanguine." He says, "I see no one truly in the Teddy Roosevelt tradition with a realistic chance of election in the United States, while the rich become more powerful and the more powerful become richer." I mean, this is a contested argument.
Sure. I think I agree with that, with what Simon is saying. I don't see anybody like Teddy Roosevelt right now. And the rich are becoming more powerful, and the more powerful are becoming richer. That's absolutely true. Look at it. I mean, you know, what are we debating right now in the political sphere? We're debating reducing the tax of the very rich. So obviously, that's not the biggest problem that the U.S. faces today. I think it will be very difficult. You know, you can argue about, you know, what's the disincentive effects of taxes, whether taxes should increase or not. But cutting the income tax on the rich is probably not the most urgent problem that the U.S. faces. So Simon is right. But the question is not whether we can today identify Teddy Roosevelt, but is the system open enough to finally rally around somebody to stop the slide?
Teddy Roosevelt, please apply here. Yeah, it could be done. On the other hand, but I'll stick with this tax question. Tim Snyder at Yale remarked to us the other day that watch out for countries where the rich aren't paying their taxes and they're shipping it to the Bahamas or Switzerland or someplace else. This is extraction by definition, and it's the beginning of the end, whether it's in Greece or in the United States, where the United States Senate won't consider the Buffett rule. I mean, one of the richest men in the country says, tax me, tax me, tax me, save yourself, and they won't do it.
I think Timothy Snyder is absolutely right. I think there is something fundamentally wrong in this day and age if in a country the middle-income people pay their taxes, but the very rich don't. And it's not just the Buffett rule, by the way. It is the fact that we don't tax profits that are not repatriated. So many corporations have huge amounts of profits, but we don't tax them because they haven't been brought back to the United States. So it's double whammy. First of all, it doesn't come back to the United States. Secondly, it doesn't get taxed. And we tax income at much lower rate because it's counted as capital income. We give huge amounts of tax breaks to the very rich. So yeah, exactly, those are real, real problems. They are exactly the same sort of problems that we faced at the end of the 19th century. And if left unchecked, it would corrupt the system. No doubt about it.
Put the Tea Party and the Occupy movement as rebel flags trying to get organized. Put them in the context of both of history and a kind of real connection with the extractive menace in this world.
I think that's exactly the right question to ask. And let me say two things. The first one is that I see the Occupy movement as the descendants of the progressives, populists, and the muckrakers. They are the people who are giving a jolt to the system. They're saying there is something fundamentally wrong here and we need to do something about it ourselves, not count on the politicians to do it, not count on CBS News and Fox News and NBC News to do it. But we ourselves, as the grassroots movement, we have to do it. And in that sense, they are a very positive development. And look, they've already impacted things so much. You know, economists knew about what was going on to income inequality, to the top of the distribution, to the top 1%. People had been writing about it. I have written about it, but nobody in the media cared about it until the Occupy movement. And the Occupy movement changed that. They made this topic an important one for people to talk about. Will the Occupy movement change things by itself? Will it take power? No, it's not a political party. It's not part of any of the two political parties. It's not going to change things overnight. But it gives me hope that the same sort of grassroots movement that did change things during the civil rights era with Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, as we talked about, during the Gilded Age, as we're talking about now, is still possible today. And the Tea Party movement, let me say something perhaps that you might find at first a little strange. I actually find the Tea Party movement, or actually found the first version of the Tea Party movement, also a positive development, because it was also a grassroots movement.
I'm with you.
That said, look, the political system is corrupt. Now, the Tea Party movement, though, became immediately taken over by the Republican Party machinery and became a wing of the Republican Party. And at that point, it ceased to be a grassroots movement. And today, I think it's part of what's wrong with the system. But the original energy of the Tea Party movement, to me, is also what's distinctive about U.S. institutions. It really makes room for these grassroots movements.
That's the good news. The fear, though, is that here we are in the turmoil of 2012 and deep anxiety. And as Chris Hedges says, you cannot vote against Goldman Sachs. I mean, Wall Street owns both presidential contenders. How does one register not only dismay, but just a vote against that system?
You cannot vote against Goldman Sachs today. But part of the reason for that is because no presidential candidate is running on a platform of cleaning up the financial act that the United States has right now. No president, no major senator is running on that platform. But, you know, what happened again with the progressive movement is that Teddy Roosevelt represented that. But after that, William Taft represented that. After that, Woodrow Wilson represented that. Right. So presidential candidates allied themselves with that movement once they understood that people really wanted this passionately. So if what American people wanted passionately was to regulate Wall Street, I'm sure that a presidential candidate would come up with. Now, I don't think regulating Wall Street would solve our problems overnight. I think it's a very complicated thing, and I think part of the reason why it hasn't become a rallying cry by itself is not just that politicians are afraid of Wall Street, which they are, because that's where a lot of money comes from for their campaigns, but also it's a complicated business. And, you know, there was a point to Hank Paulson actually calling up, you know, JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, because they pay 10 times the salaries, 20 times the salaries that the FDIC pays. So the more talented people had all gone to the banks. So there is a sort of a difficulty there, which kind of comes with where money is, that's where talent goes, that's where expertise is, and so on and so forth. So there are deeper problems there that, you know, would require somewhat of a sort of a more subtle approach, step by step. You know, you first need to sort of end the special treatment that Wall Street gets. Stop all the implicit and explicit bailouts. Start putting size caps on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And then slowly that will start solving the problems. But I think, you know, the hope still remains that when people identify what are the core set of issues around which they're willing to vote, regardless of other things, politicians will fall in line.
With the New York media, including the networks and the New York Times, the mainstream, ever tell you that Wall Street's the problem?
It's too simplistic to just say that Wall Street is the problem. Money buying power is the problem. There's nothing wrong with money. I'm an economist. I like economic prosperity. I think everybody should have more money. Right. It's when money becomes the key thing in society that buys status and power and nobody can compete against it. That's when things become real problematic.
Where are the inclusive, smaller, pluralistic, independent economic institutions to fight the big guys? Or even to ignite a different sort of politics?
What we have seen over the last 60 years is that the industrial sector in the United States gets smaller and smaller. More and more people are in non-manufacturing jobs. And some of it is just unavoidable. As society becomes richer, people demand more and more services, and manufacturing productivity increases. So there are fewer and fewer people working in the sort of old-style jobs where you make cars or TVs or so on and so forth. But in the US, it has gone on very rapidly, partly because of outsourcing and offshoring.
From George Romney's American Motors to Mitt Romney's Bain Investments.
Exactly. That's it. Yeah. And you know what that has done is that we don't have that sort of well-paid middle class that is a political voice also. If you look at the U.S. income distribution, it's not just that it has become more unequal. It has become polarized. The middle has gone to either to the very top or to the very bottom. Is that reversible? Probably not much. Hmm. So you cannot go back to the sort of industrial employment structure that you had during George Romney's time. But we can make sure that the new jobs that are emerging are higher quality. They are built on better sets of skills and education. We don't have machinists anymore, but we have technicians. We have people who are servicing computers. We have people who are working with, in the healthcare sector, for example, with MRI machines or CAT scans or other sort of health technologies. But there is no reason why these should be low-paid jobs. There's no reason why these shouldn't be high-skilled jobs. That's where the problem lies at some level. Look at the numbers. One number that really depresses me about the U.S. economy is education.
Yeah.
Our high school graduation rate for males and college graduation rate for males is still lower today than it was in the 1960s. We're not educating our men. No, we're educating our women a little better than in the 1960s. That's an important thing. But we're not educating our men.
That's especially important because you said at the beginning that education is still a badge of the American system, and yet you're also saying it's deteriorating.
Exactly. It's deteriorating. Okay. That's where, you know, what can we do about it? That's what one of the things we can do. If we start making sure that more of the men and more of the women go to college, graduate from high school, they will be able to get better jobs. The jobs that they get, even if they are in the healthcare sector, even if they are in the services industry, will be better paying jobs. And with that, they will be more of a force in the political spheres, anchoring the political institutions in the United States. Unions, old-style unions, were one of the forces that balanced the system. It's not that I'm not a blanket supporter of trade unions. When you let them unchecked, they would do as much extraction and rent seeking as any other institution. But in a society where money is very powerful and businesses and bosses are very powerful, trade unions have a useful role. Now they're gone. If you have a well-educated, active, well-paid labor force, workforce, that can be a point of balance against the role of money in politics that we talked about. So there are things to be done. So it's not all hopeless about the United States.
I want you to make connections with two other diagnoses. It's fascinating to me. The more you talk, the more you remind me of Tony Judt and his last words as he died of Lou Gehrig's disease in Ill Fares the Land. I mean, he's talking about so many of your symptoms, decline of a social democracy, again, of public institutions like transportation, education. But he was also desperately worried about a public conversation where people get the word from somebody. He was disgusted with the boomer generation, including Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, of politicians light, who were pretty kept souls. He pushed us into these conversations on how fair is the land. I mean, where do you connect with that feeling?
You know, two ideas are very important here. One is that of the public conversation. Whatever your views are, and people will disagree, it's very, very important to have these conversations. I think the worst things happen when they happen in the hidden. So if people are aware of what's going on in U.S. politics, that will put real restrictions, real constraints on what can happen. An informed public debate, not just among the intellectual elite, but really one that is broadly participatory, is very important. Second, there is something quite problematic about the collapse of social democracy, not because old-style social democracy was right or was always advocating the correct policies, but because a democracy, a pluralistic, inclusive political system can only function if different viewpoints are credibly represented. And if that disappears, there are no options.
Tony Judt was desperate to hear nonconformity in the Emersonian sense, but dissent, eccentricity, robust, real argument. Where would you begin? I mean, who would you love to pop up in the landscape to change the conversation?
Look at the Occupy movement. That's just all about dissent. There was nothing like that a year ago. It changed the landscape. Something like WikiLeaks, for example. I mean, you know, people will have their own opinions about, you know, whether it's against national security or not. But that is about dissent. It says, you know, again, you can disagree about their method. You can certainly have misgivings about Julian Assange. But it says, we're going to have a radically different opinion, a radically different approach to making information public, even information that governments want to keep secret. And that sort of suddenly changes the conversation. So we need that sort of sudden change of perspectives and conversation.
The other point I want you to connect with is again, Simon Johnson. You and he have been tweeting a sort of argument about the glass being half full or half empty. But I always think of him as the man who said, having served at the World Bank, that World Bank inspectors know, in a certain sense, when they land in Togo or Uruguay or whatever, sort of who's running this place. And they recognize states that have been captured by interests. He says, we've been captured, and it's money. And they're not taxed. They have their spokespeople. They have their institutions like the Tea Party now. They don't pay their taxes and refuse to let that get on the agenda in a presidential campaign. Wake up, America. You've been bought. How does that argument stand with you? When you and Simon meet in the corridor, how does it go?
Well, Simon is a good friend. We've worked together in the past. And I agree entirely with the argument that you know, money is too important in politics today. You can use more evocative language. You can say politics is bought today. Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. Where I think we disagree is, you know, is this a process that has irreversibly set in, or is it that U.S. institutions have the ability to regenerate themselves and provide alternatives and solutions to the problems? Perhaps I'm more optimistic on that than Simon is, but, you know, our remedies are not different. You know, what does Simon think? What do you think? I think you think that if we say loudly enough that money has become so important, that Wall Street gets huge subsidies from the government and pays it to a small group of chief executives and traders, that a lot of rich people don't pay taxes, that's going to jolt the system. Well, that's what I think too. So we just need to, in the words that you used, dissent. We just need to bring this conversation to a broader audience so that people finally feel strongly enough to do something about it at the poll booth and as a protest movement, as the Occupy Wall Street has done.
And your thoughts on 2012? What are you waiting for this year?
I'm waiting for one of the candidates to articulate at least what the serious problems we are facing are. Even if they don't articulate solutions, if they are able to articulate what the problems are, I will vote for them.
Give them a hint, a short list.
Money in politics, education system, the penal system, which locks up a lot of people, and erosion of civil liberties.
Mm. We're going to remember that. Darren Acemoglu, I can't thank you enough for the excitement of this book and the pleasures of this conversation. Our riddle now is, how fair is the land? How would you sum it up?
B minus.
B minus. That's a bad grade at MIT.
It's a failing grade.
It's a warning. Thank you. Darren Acemoglu.
Thank you. My pleasure for being here.
Darren Acemoglu's book with Professor James Robinson of Harvard is called Why Nations Fail. Our conversation at MIT was produced and edited by Aaron Wee and Mary McGrath. You can find our election year series, How Fair is the Land? And you can leave your own comments and suggestions, please, at our website, radioopensource.org. And you can follow what we're up to on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.